Welcome back to Everything is Public Health. I'm MJ.
And I'm Cass.
You own a home or a house, something that is increasingly rare and out of reach for the younger generation. How is owning a home like?
Well, I will say me owning a home is 100% because my husband was able to own a home before we ever met. When I was done with school, I had so much student loan debt. Mm-hmm. There was no way that I could feasibly afford a mortgage because my student loan repayment at the time was like $1,000 a month.
Wow, that is rent.
Yeah, it was a lot. He owned a house already when we met, and it's the only reason I own a house now, to be totally honest.
Yeah, it's getting kind of ridiculous now, but today's topic is not about home ownership, even though I'm sure that could be a future topic very easily. But you know, you currently have a house, have a home. Have you ever had to worry about like electrical wiring or anything electrical in your house in your life in general, or did you mostly just hire someone and forget about it? You're nodding like crazy. People can't see this.
Yeah. So we live in an older house. It was built in, I think, 64, maybe, which is when they used aluminum wiring.
Yes.
So you can't just go buy like regular electrical outlets and replace them.
Yeah.
You have to do this thing called like piggybacking to swap them over. And because our house was so old and so much of the appliances were run on gas, we had a very limited amount of electrical capacity in the house.
Wow.
So we had to spend a whole bunch of money to do what's called a heavy up, where you like add more capacity, more fuse boxes or whatever in the electrical panel. So my dad, super skilled, you know, taught me lots of things growing up. And so I know some of the very basic things, but things that I can't see that can kill me have always terrified me.
Yes.
So like electricity and gas, like, you know, those are two things I'm not a giant fan of sort of doing stuff with.
That's a very rational fear.
Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, we have an older house. It makes home improvements slightly more challenging.
I feel like this is one of those cases where you 100% want a professional. I don't think you want to DIY anything.
No, and I am all about doing as much for myself as I possibly can. James is the same. Like, we have handy skills, but again,
not this.
Invisible things that can kill me, I am terrified by.
And give it to the professionals for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it seems like you're very, you know, intimately familiar with how electricity and wiring works.
That's a stretch, but I have just enough knowledge to make me dangerous, but not enough to like make me useful. How about that?
I think that's great. So I landed on this topic when I was doing my other hobby, writing trivia questions for the trivia games that I make.
Of course.
And I went down this rabbit hole of electrical outlets, which got me thinking, electrical outlets probably aren't always this modern and safe, right? When I remember I was a kid, I see a lot more, in fact, exclusively two-prong outlets.
Yep.
Versus the more
the ones that look like faces.
Typical three prongs. Yeah.
The one that looks like
you just did a thing. Exactly. We both did the same face of like opening mouth because the bottom prong is rounded. Uh-huh. And I feel like they knew exactly what they were doing when they were making this prong. It's like, let's make it look like a face. But anyway, so I remember when I was a kid, pretty much every electrical outlet was two pronged instead of three prongs. Well, here's for the electrician cast of this podcast. What does the third prong do?
Oh, I actually know this.
Oh, go ahead.
It's grounding. So like it helps keep the circuit safe.
Yes, exactly. Essentially, it's a safety feature, right? The reason why we have it now is because it's a safety feature. You can operate whatever device it is with only two main prongs. In fact, some, you know, sketchy DIY places will say, well, if you only have a two-prong outlet, you just need to shave off the third prong and it will work just as well. You're right. The third prong has nothing to do with the functioning of whatever device that you're plugging it into. However, it's a safety feature because if whatever device that you're holding shorts or whatever, and you don't have that third prong, you are the ground and you don't want to be the ground because that's how electrocution happens. So the third prong is essentially a detour, I guess, a speedier detour for electricity to go in case there is a short.
Yeah. And if you think about, you know, we watch old movies, whatever, people would unfortunately fill up a bathtub, climb into it and throw their radio into the bathtub while it was plugged in an attempt to
self-harm, right?
You know, electrocute themselves or harm themselves in some way. And a lot of people sort of my age growing up, not that they tried that, but they were like, oh, I don't think that actually works. Like the thing just shorts out. It turns off. Like it doesn't make
because
any sense.
Because of the safety feature.
Because now there's that third prong that diverts things. I don't know how accurate that actually was. I mean, it had to have been.
Don't try it.
Don't try it at home. But I mean, there had to be some truth to it because it was a really common trope that would come out in that.
On TV.
Yeah. So when I was a kid, yeah, both the outlets were, I don't know that I noticed all that much about the physical outlet other than, you know, if it had two holes or three holes and what you could plug in where, but the actual plugs on these things were janky. They were so, so poor quality. All of these plugs on everything that we would use. Now, often there's like little reinforcement to help it curve when it comes off
insulation.
The plug. Yeah, things are insulated. Yeah. Like, I remember we would have plugs that were like frayed and all sorts of damage to them.
Yes. They break so easily. Yeah.
Yeah. That was just what would happen because you would plug something in and the plug would hang down and eventually it would break open. So I think there's far sturdier plugs and even like extension cords and that kind of stuff. It's much more robust now, less easy to break. And most of the plugs that I had growing up already had the grounding thing, but not all of them. So there were sometimes we couldn't plug 3-prong things into 2-prong outlets.
Yeah. And I also grew up in Taiwan. So there's probably some sort of, you know, country and cultural differences. I rarely see 3-prong outlets in Taiwan when I was growing up. I hope things are different now.
How old were you when you left Taiwan?
I was like 8. So I was relatively young. I'm sure things are different now. Also, I remember if you plug something in and if you were to yank it out like 6 inches away from the plug, the thing would just separate. And just exposed wire.
Oh, that's not what I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to say, like, I remember sometimes as a kid, I would plug something into the wall.
Uh-huh.
And if you unplugged it too fast, you'd see a zap of electricity
between
the outlet and the plug. Yeah.
Well, that's why the safety 3-prong is for, amongst a bunch of other things that neither of us are qualified electrician to really comment on. But safety features abound in our modern home. That is sort of the point. Real quick, any other things you want to point out between outlets of your youth and now? You were born slightly earlier, so
Yeah, I think one other thing, and this may have just been like that the house that I was in, but it seems like more modern designs have electrical outlets everywhere.
Yes. Oh my God.
Like,
oh my God, yes.
In my house growing up, we had one outlet per room.
Yes.
And then we had all of these crazy extender plugs or power strips or whatever coming out because you literally had one plug in a room. And I think people have realized, again, like thinking about when many of these houses were designed and built, most stuff like the appliances and everything were gas. And so then you needed, you know, a lamp in the room or like a plug for the radio. You didn't really need
all these appliances.
You didn't have TVs and Xboxes and all these other things. Houses that I was in growing up, there were not enough plugs.
I noticed
in
that
any
too.
Of the rooms. Like, and we had these like crazy
daisy chains,
crazy things like coming up.
Extension cords. Yeah.
Like you think about what is it? Christmas Story, when they've got all those things plugged into that one and he like tries to plug in one more thing and like almost catches fire and he's like fanning it out.
Was that Christmas Story? That might be something else.
I thought it was a Christmas Story when they were setting up all the decorations. Who knows? It was a movie I saw regularly as a child.
It's a trope. Films back then sort of illustrated. But yeah, I remember you have to plug extension cord on top of extension cords, which, surprise, is how electrical fires happen because you're overloading one of the outlets, which is puny from older houses. They can't handle that much things plugged into it. But yeah, you know, today's topic is all about electricity and electrical safety in the home. The history of electrification, or the process of converting homes from gas powered to electric powered, was surprisingly hard to find. Other topics I Google, I could pretty much find a bunch of articles on. All I found when Googling these was a bunch of electrical companies talking about their own history. And this year we started our company and we started providing. There's not a lot of like news article about this or like, you know, historical articles about this. So I couldn't find much and I'm not sure why. Maybe someone who knows more about this part of history can tell me. But you know, in the late 1800s, it was the DC versus AC war, Thomason versus Tesla. They were trying to electrify everything and it was a very, very slow process because buildings were already built.
We should probably describe for people what DC and AC are, direct current versus alternating
current.
Oh
man. Okay, I'll try to keep this as brief as possible. DC stands for direct current and it is the type of current that Thomas Edison, the notorious egomaniac and, you know, not a good person, was championing. Basically, very simple. Direct current is you have electrical source on one end and you're just going to pump that electricity down a wire to the other end. The problem with DC is that, you know, America is big and this might work over half a mile. This might work over a mile, but for DC to work, you essentially need to have generators on every block. That's essentially how DC currents would work, which obviously we don't have because it's not efficient. Nikola Tesla championed AC, which stands for alternating current, which, you know, long story short, basically sends a current back and forth very quickly and uses the frequency alternating current and a transformer at the other end to deliver electricity that way. I'm probably butchering the physical description of it.
No, I think that's great. I'll just, yes, and we think about AC, so alternating current, right, is when we're distributing power, right? As you said, sometimes it needs to go back and forth. Maybe we send power to one place and we need to pull it and send it to another place, right? Sort of distribution. DC direct current, like batteries, or when you charge an electronic device or something like that, where you don't want it to come back the other way. You don't want power to go back into the battery. You want power to just go to whatever you're using.
Yeah. So most, I want to say nearly all of our electrical grid is AC because it's just more efficient sending things over long distance.
The only potential exception is, so solar panels are direct current, obviously, right? Because you don't want the stuff going back to...
Well, the solar panel is the generator, essentially.
Yes, exactly. You might have solar panels feeding only one way into the power grid, but then the power grid is AC and can distribute it all over the place.
That's pretty much the gist.
Look at that, man. Pulling back out some... some old undergraduate stuff there.
That's essentially the gist. This is as much, you know, an undergraduate degree would let us know. I'm sure electricians out there are fuming at our overgeneralization and inaccuracy.
Send us a note.
We would love to learn. But anyway, you know, people used to have gas and they realized electricity is much better because, surprise, gas powered home comes with its own host of safety concerns, arguably more scary than electricity. I don't know. How do you feel about gas-powered homes?
Well, I live in one.
Oh, that's true. I feel like there's a lot more safety concerns with gas-powered homes.
I don't know. There are lots of rules and regulations about the kinds of nozzles and valves and that kind of stuff. So I think people are, I don't know, maybe this is not right. Maybe this is just in my mind. But I think people are more thoughtful about how a gas leak could harm people than poorly wired homes. And I think that's because we've made a lot of sort of advancements in the how we ground things with the three plugs and insulating wires and things like that. And maybe people just think gas is less safe because we sort of see electricity all the time and people don't even really think about, it's not like you're plugging something in to gas, right? You plug something into the wall and you think about electricity. I don't know, maybe that doesn't resonate, but that's sort of what we do have a carbon monoxide detector in the house.
As every home should, we could talk about that in another episode.
Invisible things that can kill me are terrifying.
For sure.
Yes, have a smoke detector, have a carbon monoxide alarm.
Gotta have those. Yeah, I think a big part of it is also the efficiency of electricity, but you know, the gist is, at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of 19th century, we started the electrification process, converting homes from gas power to electricity power. Only half of the homes in 1925 were electrified under FDR's New Deal. FDR had a huge push to electrify more homes under the Rural Electrification Act of 1936, which sped it up, and 85% of the homes were electrified by 1945 and nearly all in 1960. But I think the important thing to note is it's kind of recent, right? It's not like I guess it's almost a century, but you know, we had to retrofit a lot of things is what I'm trying to say. A lot of homes were built before 1960. We had to do a lot of retrofitting. But as soon as we had electricity in the homes, there were electrical fires and other related electrical injuries like shocks and electrocutions. Unfortunately, I couldn't get actual numbers and rates on these incidents. Again, really hard to find for some reason on the internet. But we know that they did happen and they happened quite frequently.
Right. And we think about the development of or sort of expansion of fire service, fire departments, because, you know, you think about candles and those kinds of things potentially causing fires prior to, but those risks of fires didn't go away, as you're saying, when they electrified, even though people maybe weren't using candles. Instead, there were other issues and as many, if not more, fires, perhaps, as more people gained access to electricity.
Yeah, unfortunately, that data is not public. It leads me to my second point. Now, I would love to say that this is a classic feel-good public health story of we realized there was a problem, so we went on to fix it to improve the safety of houses and save lives and prevent entry. I would love to say that it is a classic feel-good story, but what do you think actually happened? How do we get from unsafe houses to safe houses, if you were to guess?
Oh, that's a good question. I would guess that it was something to do with the electrical companies wanting to sort of expand electrical access. And so if people had electricity in their home and they're burning down from fires or they're getting shocked, people might be like, hey, I don't want to do that. And so the electrical companies were sort of out of their own self-preservation, self-interest. I don't know, maybe it wasn't just electrical companies, but I could see some sort of capitalistic interest driving the evolution of these safe products.
You are almost right. You got the capital interest part down. So let me give you a hint. The reason why I couldn't find any data on this is not because there wasn't any data collected. There were data collected about electrical fires and electrical injuries. Who collected them, you think?
I mean, I'm going to go back to the same answer I had before, the electrical companies.
What sort of industry is interested in knowing accidents, accident rates, and fire rates?
Oh, insurance companies.
Ding, ding, ding. That is the correct answer.
Hello, that was, I have not had enough coffee. I mean, insurance rules the world.
Yes, let's follow the logical train of thought.
I was thinking of it sort of from the electrical company's perspective, but it makes sense that—
Yeah, they played a role in this too.
Like, why would companies be worried about people not using their products? It's because maybe the insurance companies would charge higher rates, or they wouldn't insure houses that had certain things. So yeah, insurance companies rule the world.
Yeah, so it's a little bit too optimistic to say that electrical companies like were the first to be like, no, we want to make the place safer. Nope, that is not what happened.
No, to be fair, I wasn't saying they wanted to make the places safer. They wanted to make money. And in order to make money, they had to design a product that wouldn't burn people's houses down.
The momentum behind that was a bunch of fire insurance company people. They're called underwriters. I'm not sure whether that term still exists in the modern lingo, but they're called underwriters, but they basically say, hey, these things causes fire. We're going to stop insuring people that have these things. And that was the momentum. So that's the push for more electrical safety, is the insurance companies either raise their rates or just flat out would stop insuring people. And that was the reason why we live in a safe place. And then building codes became a thing. So our current building codes for electricity, like electrical wiring, came from recommendation from an organization called the National Fire Protection Association, which is a private trade association, right? So a lot of this is, again, I didn't have enough time to dive too deep into history, but the general gist is what I've described. Like, insurance company or these trade organization are like, this is not safe. And then those recommendations are then adopted by local and state authorities as the building code. And that's how we got to the safer places that we have today. It's all money. It's all insurance. It's all capitalism.
I mean, this is a slight tangent, but how we got many of the innovations that got us to safer cars was through the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety.
I hate it.
Like, insurance group, right? They got together and they sort of started rating cars for safety and setting standards and things. So
I'm not sure how I feel about this, to be perfectly honest. It's not bad, I guess.
On one hand, I can sort of see why you're twitchy around sort of the capitalist side of this, but I don't know, and maybe you'll find a special place in hell for me for saying this, but I would argue that not all facets of capitalism are horrible. There are some facets, like promoting safety and innovation and those kinds of things, that can come from, now, capitalism as sort of the end goal, not great. But when there's competition, when there is sort of tension in a market, you can see innovation and safety, because if there are two equally costing products and one will burn my house down and one will not,
right,
I'm going to buy the one that's not going to burn my house down, right?
I am not going to get on my leftist socialist soapbox.
Don't get on your soapbox.
I'm not going to, but I will say there is some merit in that line of logic of like, well, it's about competition, right? It's about, you know, you follow the money, right? There is a sort of logic to that. I think I just want to add, if it was cheaper to let people get hurt and die, they would let it happen.
Right, but it's not cheaper. That's the whole point.
Exactly. We have to make the safest thing, or we have to make unsafe things more expensive for them to react.
Or safer things cheaper.
One of those things needs to happen, which is great as a motivator, but it's me being my cynical self is like, that is such a sad thing. Like, we have to make the safer thing cheaper, otherwise they won't do it.
I mean, but that's a core tenet of injury prevention. We have the four E's. We educate people to do the right thing or not do the wrong thing. We design environments through engineering to make them safer. We enforce laws and rules for when people don't do the right thing. And we use economic incentives and disincentives to get people to do the safe thing. So it's not even necessarily a capitalism thing. It's also sort of one of the core ways. Like, we make the safest thing, the easiest thing, the cheapest thing. And that's how you make people safer.
Through whatever regulations and policies or whatever. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that. All right, anyway, to do our due diligence, we're going to just very quickly talk about why building codes, electrical safety, is public health.
Yeah. I mean, we
sort of covered it. Yeah.
I mean, we've talked about it a little bit, but when you think about a rising tide lifting all ships, right? You could say, Cass, you as an individual are responsible for figuring out what's the safest way to put electricity into your house. And that would perhaps make me safe and maybe, you know, moderately improve the safety of my neighbors because my house won't burn down. But it also, I'm at risk of my neighbor's houses burning down, right? Because everyone's doing something different. And public health is all about population level solutions, policies, interventions that make things the same, right? We talked about pasteurization a couple of episodes ago. You know, we're talking about, you know, design standards for building codes, you know, electrical safety kinds of things. And the goal is to make it, basically, you don't have to make any extra choices
exactly
to get the benefit. And then in order to be harmed, you actually have to be active. And one of the things we love in public health are passive interventions. I do literally nothing and I achieve the benefit.
Yes.
As opposed to an active intervention like putting on a bike helmet or buckling my seatbelt, right? But in a car, airbags are a passive intervention that can help minimize the harm. I don't have to do anything. Now I could actively turn my airbags off.
You can't.
Which you used to be able to. Right? I don't think you can anymore. But when I was a kid, you'd stick your driver key into the airbag thing and turn it off.
That's not right. Anyway.
But like it basically, you have to take an action as opposed to doing nothing and reaping the benefit. So that's why these things are such an important part of public health.
Yes, very well put. I don't need to add anything to that. One thing I discovered during my shallow dive into electric building codes or just building codes in general, none of it is federal. They're all state and local. Every building code in this country is state and local.
That makes sense.
Yay, but also, at the same time, I guess it makes sense. A federal government probably be hard for them to enforce like a federal building code. It kind of makes sense, but I didn't realize that. I didn't realize every building code in this country is state and local.
Even housing that is built by the Federal Housing Authority doesn't have federal building codes?
I did not look into that exception, but from what I can see, all building codes are state and local.
Interesting.
But obviously there might be exceptions. Yeah. Again, very shallow dive. I spent 2 hours on this, so please don't add me.
But also like on one hand, it makes a lot of sense because different places have access to different things. There are probably places in the US where like having gas powered, like it doesn't make any sense. Like where I grew up, I don't think anybody had gas. I did not know that gas-powered stuff was a thing until I moved to the East Coast. And it could just be like the timing of when things were...
West Coast is newer,
right? Yeah. Yes, obviously newer in the suburb of Seattle, which was, you know, I think the house was maybe built in the 80s. So, you know, a little newer. No reason to have gas. Yeah, but if so, it makes sense having that variability.
Yeah, I will say, even though the actual building codes and regulations are state and local, they all draw from the same recommendation source, which is the National Electrical Codes from the National Fire Protection Association.
Which is a sort of like federal-ish.
And it's not the law, but the laws draw from them. So it's kind of the law, whatever, right? This is a whole can of worms that we can go down that I'm not going to. Before we wrap, we're going to talk about some cool electrical safety features.
Yeah, so I just, like we were talking earlier about the different kinds of plugs. And I think one really cool innovation is like in the physical plug itself. So when I grew up, and actually in my entire house, all of the plugs are sort of the traditional plugs that rely on the circuit breaker in the electrical box.
Yes.
So if something shorts out, it pops a circuit or blows a fuse and you got to go down into the basement and swap the thing. But people realized, one, that's probably not super safe.
Yes.
And two, what a pain in the ass to always have to go flip the breaker.
The motivation is the pain in the butt.
Yes. And so now there's these great innovations that have been around for a long time, but you know, they're not in some of the older houses, but these ground fault circuit interrupter where there's a circuit in the switch. So I was just traveling. I was at a hotel, the plug in the bathroom. It's got the little button.
Yeah. The test reset.
Yeah, test and reset buttons, right? So you plug your hairdryer in, it doesn't work. Oh, let me push this button because clearly something popped that little circuit right in the plug. It minimizes the likelihood that something has to go all the way out to the breaker to pop versus just doing it right there and keeping everything super contained. It's just a really cool way.
It is.
That we continue to innovate to try to minimize injury and fires.
Yeah. And this was actually on my physics final in undergrad. They talk about ground fault circuit interrupters and how they worked. Essentially, if you have a device that's running on electricity, the electricity going into the device has to be the same as the electricity going out of the device. If there is a discrepancy, like there's more electricity going in than out, that means electricity is leaving that device and onto someone. So if you detect a difference, you trip the circuit and boom, device stops working. That's sort of how it works. They are required by law well, by building codes, right, on every electrical outlet that is potentially near moisture. So you see these in bathrooms, in kitchens, and you see them in outdoors. It used to be just near swimming pools, but then people realized there's water in other places of the home, not just swimming pools. So they started implementing these everywhere. And this is a fun chart. I will share my screen to show you. So this is from Electrical Safety Foundation. I don't know whether they're private or not, but this is the over the years estimate number of GFCI protected homes and total electrocution. And you can see a direct negative correlation. The more homes that are protected by GFCI, the less electrocutions there are.
Yeah, go back up to the chart at the beginning. No, that's it. So that blue line, yeah, GFCs installed and overall electrocutions and computer product. Yeah, that's great.
Yes. So you see a direct negative correlation. If you want a simple stats project to do a linear regression, this is a perfect data set to do so. Very simple to do. But yeah, electricity is all around us. Electrical safety is public health. Thank you for listening to this episode of Everything is Public Health. We don't run ads and we're fully independent, and we will never run ads. If you hear an ad when listening to this show, that's been placed there against our will. If you like the show, please share it with your friends, family, and acquaintances. That is the best thing you can do to help us. Tell everyone how awesome and ubiquitous public health is.
Please follow us on Threads, Instagram, and Mastodon, all at Everything is Public Health, and also Blue Sky Social at Everything is PH. We are no longer on the Twitter. You can find me on Threads at CastPhD or on LinkedIn.
New episodes are released every Thursday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave us a rating and a review. It does help the show immensely. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or think we missed an important perspective, please reach out to us at everythingispublichealth@gmail.com.
If you want to support the show directly, we have a Patreon page, which also acts like our website. Follow us there for all major updates and bonus material. And remember, everything is public health.
Everything is public health.